From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. With about a month to go before Election Day, we check in on the do's and don'ts of absentee ballot voting. We'll also hear about the state of the race for governor and U.S. Senate in New Hampshire, plus a look at what's happening in politics in the state of Maine. And we begin a series on down-ballot races, exploring what role county attorneys play in New Hampshire. All that and more on today's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And let's start today's program by talking with NHPR's Casey McDermott, who has been covering how this election is proceeding. Casey, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And listeners, now is a great time to get your questions about absentee ballots answered. Give us a call now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Casey, as you've been reporting, the state is allowing anyone who is concerned about COVID to vote absentee in this election. So what's happening right now? Are people requesting ballots and receiving them and turning them in right now?
They are. And so first of all, I just, obviously there's a lot of news this morning. And I just want to start by saying, I think, like everyone, I'm hoping for, everyone in the White House to stay safe and those in contact with them to stay safe and healthy. So, we'll continue following that. But as far as how voting is happening here in New Hampshire, absentee ballots went out last week to voters. People should be receiving them pretty soon. If you haven't received yours yet, don't panic. It may just be that your clerk's office has, only recently mailed them out or it's on its way to you. But if you do have concerns, you can contact your clerk's office to find out the status of your absentee ballot. Okay. But, yep.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you can also still request a ballot if you haven't done that yet. So that's also an option for people. You should know that you can request an absentee ballot up until the day before the election. And in fact, you can also show up at the polls and request an absentee ballot through a process called accessible absentee voting as well.
So absentee is not meant simply for people who are out of state. You can be present. You don't have to be absent. You can be in the town clerk's office and request one of these ballots and then cast it right there.
Exactly. So this year, New Hampshire, as we've been reporting, has expanded the eligibility for absentee voting. So previously, you would need to meet certain state-approved excuses. But this year, they've expanded that to anyone who's concerned about COVID-19. So that's meant that lots of people are voting absentee for the first time this year.
And so let's talk a little bit about some of the issues regarding absentee ballots, because there are a few extra steps. And like anything that involves extra steps, there's a greater chance that something will go wrong. So let's talk about rejected absentee ballots first, because, of course, absentee ballots, they're not a new thing. How many absentee ballots are usually rejected because of an error with a voter or something else?
Sure. So I think it's important to stress to people that the vast majority of absentee ballots are counted without issue. So there's no need to panic here. At the same time, though, like you said, there are certain mistakes or other issues that could cause someone's absentee ballot to be rejected. So we don't have the data for the September primary. We are trying to get that, and we hope to be able to share that with people soon. What we do have is data from the last four federal elections. So this is 2018 through 2012. And looking at that, about 2%, between 2% and 3% of absentee ballots were rejected in each of those elections. And when we looked at the data a little bit more closely, this is information that's reported by every state in the country to the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. We looked at the data, and the most common reason, actually, that New Hampshire voters' absentee ballots have been rejected in those last four elections was because the ballots arrived too late. And that's a really critical thing. People should know that in New Hampshire, your ballot, your completed absentee ballot, has to arrive by 5 p.m. on election day in order to be counted.
So it doesn't matter when it's postmarked. It matters when it arrives.
Exactly. There is a court case that is trying to change that, but definitely go with the current rules right now, which is that 5 p.m. deadline still holds. And that applies, it's important to note, whether you're hand delivering your ballot, whether you're having someone else drop it off for you. And there's only certain people that are allowed to drop off someone else's ballot. We have more information on that in a voter guide on nhpr.org. But so that applies whether it's mailed, whether it's hand delivered, what have you. But the other, there are other things that can also, cause someone's ballot to be rejected. One of the other really common issues, and this is borne out in the data, this is also something that I've heard talking to lots of local election officials that are reviewing the ballots and making sure that they're processed appropriately, is when you get an absentee ballot in New Hampshire, you'll get two envelopes with it. There's an inner envelope that has an affidavit on it, and there are places on that affidavit for you to sign. And basically what you should think about is that that affidavit is telling election officials that you are eligible to vote, that you're following the law to the best of your knowledge. So it's really important to not skip over that step in signing that inner envelope that you put your ballot in, because that's something that can cause your ballot to be rejected if you don't sign that inner envelope. The other thing that can cause your ballot to be rejected is if you don't include that envelope at all. So missing envelopes are another reason that people's absentee ballots have been rejected in the past as well. So again, this just reinforces there's obviously a lot of new information, a lot of instructions that people may be trying to process this election season that they may not be familiar with. But it's really, really important to read all the directions carefully, and also to reach out if you need help. The best way to do that is really to contact your local election official, or if you're in a position to be able to do this, many local clerk's offices are open. If not for kind of normal business hours, then for like limited hours, and especially to kind of accommodate people trying to request and return absentee ballots before the election. So the other thing that you could do if you're concerned you're going to make a mistake is contact your clerk, find out if they're going to be open. Again, if this is something that you're in a position to do, consider, filling out your absentee ballot at your city or town hall so that you can have someone right there to answer your questions while you're going through the process.
Let's say, Casey, that you are filling it in at home and you send it in with plenty of time and it arrives, but there's a problem with the signature and they reject your ballot. Does the town notify the voter? Does the town say, hey, we had to reject this ballot because your signature didn't match?
So that's actually not required by law, but it is strongly encouraged. There's some changes in the rules this year for how absentee ballots are processed, and communities this year are allowed to start pre-processing absentee ballots. That means basically checking, starting to check that people have followed all the directions and met all the requirements a few days before the election. And one of the things that change has done is it has given election officials more time to potentially reach out to voters and contact them if they have made a mistake on their ballot. And I've talked to a few local election officials in different communities where they had a lot of absentee ballots, where they said they were actually able to reach out and contact almost all of the voters that they had flagged ahead of the election because their absentee ballots had issues. And they were able to help those voters, fix the issues, which, as we said, are often as simple as forgetting a signature, forgetting an envelope, something very, kind of a clerical error more than anything. So again, not required, but it is encouraged. And the other thing to keep in mind with that is that there's a place on your absentee ballot paperwork that asks for your phone number or contact information. And what I've heard from local election officials is that if you make sure to write that down, because that will make it so much easier if they are in a position to contact you, to get in touch with you. So that'll make it more likely that if there is a problem, you can have a chance to remedy it. But again, that's not required. So that's why it's even more important to, you know, to just double, triple check that you're doing it correctly ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Casey, you mentioned that poll workers can start processing ballots. Does that mean they're also going to start counting the ballots?
No. So absentee ballots and ballots cast through a kind of traditional manner on election day are all counted at the same time. So people don't need to worry that, you know, I've heard from local election officials that they get calls from people saying, well, you know, my absentee ballot isn't going to get counted unless, you know, there are certain kind of conditions with the election results or things like that, if it's close. And that is simply not true. Your absentee ballot gets counted like any other ballot that is cast on election day, and it does not get counted until election day.
But that does speak to the level of trust and public confidence that people have here, because people have a lot of questions about whether or not absentee ballots are going to be cast. What, in your reporting, what are you encountering when it comes to the level of public trust in this year's election?
I think, you know, what I'm hearing from local election officials, and I think, you know, like anyone, what I'm seeing, hearing in, you know, in the news, in social media, in just conversations, is there is a lot of confusion and there is a lot of, frankly, misinformation and disinformation about voting this year. What we're trying to do at NHPR is to provide reliable, up-to-date information to the best of our knowledge, and also to send people, again, to those trusted sources of their local clerks, state officials that are charged with election oversight. Those are really the best places to get reliable information. But that said, you know, clerks, other poll workers are telling me that they do hear over and over and over again, you know, people that are concerned for a variety of reasons about the integrity of the process. And one of the things that's also come up that is really, I think, important for people to keep in mind here in New Hampshire is that elections in New Hampshire are run by your neighbors. So your poll workers are people who live in your community. This is not someone, or, you know, these are people that, you know, many of them are really trying to do their best to do this right. And there are people that, you know, they take their job very seriously. They feel strongly about, you know, democracy and making sure that the process is handled in a trustworthy manner. And the other thing to keep in mind is that many poll workers this year are under a lot of strain. They have a lot of responsibility placed on them. There's a lot of new requirements that they are trying to keep up with as well. So I think that it also, you know, it's just really important for all of us who are, you know, part of the voting population here in the state to, you know, extend a little bit of grace to election officials right now. And, you know, to turn to them for questions, but also to be patient if, you know, they may take a little bit longer to return your calls, or, you know, you might not be getting a response or getting your absentee ballot as quickly as you think you should. There's often a reason for that. And it's a perfectly legitimate reason. And it's important to not necessarily jump to conclusions if something is not going the way that you think it should.
Listeners, now's a great time to get your questions about voting answered. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. We realize that people have a lot of questions about this process, given the pandemic, given new rules about absentee voting. We just want to note, too, that the Exchange has reached out multiple times to the Secretary of State's office, asking them to join this show to discuss voting and answer questions. We have not heard back, but we are hoping to have someone from the Secretary of State's office on the show soon. Casey, you mentioned that, you know, if you go to the town hall and you try to vote early in person with an absentee ballot, they'll likely be able to answer your questions. What about guidance from the state? To what extent has the state offered comprehensive guidance to voters?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the state does put out a lot of like kind of official memos. They have some instructions on the Secretary of State's website. If you're, really looking to get in the weeds, if you're kind of an election nerd like I am, there is a 400-page election procedure manual, which is, very lively reading for those of us who are interested in the mechanics of the voting process. And I mean that sincerely, honestly. That's actually where I turn if I have a question about a particular part of the process, because it's laid out in detail in there, in many cases. But that all said, I think what I've heard also a little bit is that, for as much as local clerks are happy to answer questions from their voters and from the public, the state, I've heard from a few people that the Secretary of State's office could be doing more to be more proactive in putting out easy to digest instructions to people. I will say candidly, I cast an absentee ballot in the September primary. I will likely do so in the November election. I went to my local city hall to handle the process, and I was thankful that I did because I had some questions, and I'm someone who covers elections.
Can I ask you what question you had, Casey, or is
I
that too
think
personal?
I mean, it's, I think it was just making sure that I was signing in the right places, making sure that I was checking the right boxes. There's a lot of information on the paperwork that voters have to fill out in New Hampshire. And that, was just something that, has come up over and over again in the course of reporting on elections. But, I can attest to that firsthand. And that's the way it is here in New Hampshire, and that's why it's good to, ask questions and make sure that you're understanding the process clearly. And I think, the thing to keep in mind too is that, I, like many other voters, you want to make sure that you're doing it correctly, and you want to make sure that you're following the rules and following the laws. And people take voting very seriously. So of course it, it's again important not to sound like a broken record, but just to double check that you're following the requirements, or that you have done everything that you need to do sooner rather than later. But to get back to your original question, I think that it's fair to say that I've heard from a number of people that they would like to see the state do more to be more proactive about sharing simple, easy to understand instructions, perhaps graphics or explainers of here's how you, fill out this part, here's how you fill out that part. And again, they have material on their website. It just can be sometimes hard to find or can be a little bit unclear.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. And let's go to the phones and talk to David in Keene. David, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I heard her say that the absentee votes get counted on election day, and I'm hearing that there are going to be a lot of absentee votes. And I'm wondering why are they being so restrictive on the particular amount of time that they can count? Why don't they expand the amount of time, or why isn't there more time to count the votes?
David, thank you very much for your question. Casey McDermott.
So that's a good question. What I can tell you is that there have been some accommodations in what they can pre-process. So like we said, that's opening the outer envelope. We were talking earlier about the envelopes that you get when you're casting an absentee ballot. There's the inner envelope that you sign and that you put your absentee ballot inside. You seal that, and then there's an outer envelope that kind of transports your inner envelope and your absentee ballot to your local election official.
So they're taking some time-saving
Yes,
measures,
they're
right?
taking some time-saving measures.
But why not that
But
final
to David,
measure?
well, so you would have to ask the state about that. But I can tell you that there are a number of election officials that have asked for more leeway in, what they can do before the election to deal with the large volume of absentee ballots that they are anticipating this year. And it's not just a matter of counting the ballots, it's also a matter of how much of that pre-election kind of you know, paperwork and record keeping they can handle before the election. The Secretary of State's office has been somewhat more restrictive than what, you know, some local poll workers and election officials would like in terms of how, for example, they can mark the voter checklist before election day. That's come up after the state primary. There's a number of local election officials who have said that they would like the governor actually to issue some kind of order or take other action to, you know, basically allow them to more clearly mark the voter checklist when they're pre-processing, when they're doing that pre-election paperwork. Because what's happened is that they can do all this work before election day, but they still have to do, they have to kind of finish up the process on election day while they're also trying to check in and deal with in-person voters. So there's been some concern that without that change, according to election officials, that that could lead to some kind of, you know, traffic jams, for lack of a better term, at polling places or at, you know, where the voter checklist is inside a polling place on election day. So this is maybe a little bit, you know, it may sound a little bit like bureaucratic or in the weeds, but a lot of these kinds of, you know, more behind the scenes mechanics of the voting process can make a big difference in many cases in how, you know, smoothly and efficiently things run at a polling place. So that's kind of a long-winded answer of saying that, you know, Dave has not been the only one who's been wondering about that.
Yeah.
We've not heard a firm answer from the state yet in terms of whether there's going to be any more leeway in terms of the amount of pre-processing that local election officials can do, but we will definitely keep an eye on that.
We've got a couple more questions from listeners, Casey, in just a couple of minutes. I hope we can get answers to both of these. One person wrote in to ask, if I receive an absentee ballot, can I not fill it out and go and vote in person if I change my mind?
Yes. The answer clear is yes. The thing to understand is that obviously if you're one person, you only get one vote.
Okay.
So you can do that. And that's actually another reason why ballots show up as being rejected sometimes, because you can also send in an absentee ballot. And if your absentee ballot has not yet been counted, you can show up and ask to, you know, kind of change your vote and vote in person. Again, there's a lot of kind of conditions to make sure that you don't cast two votes, but that's also an option in some cases for people.
And really quickly, Casey, 10 seconds or so, is there a way to verify that your vote was actually received and tabulated?
You can call your local clerk's office. You can also go to the Secretary of State's website and you can track your absentee ballot. There's not a similar mechanism for in-person voting, traditional voting in a voting booth, but for absentee balloting, in many cases, you should be able to look that up.
Well, Casey McDermott, thank you very much. We really appreciate your reporting on this.
Thanks, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll take a look at the gubernatorial race coming up after a break. This is NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And with just over 4 weeks until Election Day, candidates for statewide office are making their case to voters. In the gubernatorial race, Governor Chris Sununu is running for a third term against Democratic challenger Dan Feltes. And for a look at this race, we turn now to NHPR's Josh Rogers. Hey, Josh.
Good morning, Peter.
And listeners, just a reminder that you can weigh in with your questions or comments. What means the most to you in this gubernatorial race? What issue is on the top of your mind? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You can also email your questions. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. So, Josh, let's talk about the key arguments each candidate's making. What are they?
Well, Governor Sununu is largely running on his time managing the COVID crisis and, you know, his estimation being a good steward for the state in a time when the state faced great challenges, both public health challenges and economic challenges, and that he is, you know, essentially been a reliable leader. Democrats are largely running against him as somebody who they believe has been too much of essentially fellow traveler with Donald Trump. You may have heard the soundbite from the ad they're running right now, where Governor Sununu said some time ago that described himself on a radio show as a Trump guy through and through. They're trying to link him to Trump, and they're also pointing to his many vetoes in the legislature, saying that he's been a block to progress on priorities of theirs, such as lifting the minimum wage, campaign finance laws, potentially bills involving clean energy. And, you know, their argument and the argument that Dan Feltes, essentially his campaign was predicated on, was this one, and that a lot of it has to do with policies out of the State House, be it the paid family leave bill that Governor Sununu vetoed twice that Dan Feltes was the lead author on. And so their argument is that Sununu's been a block on progress, and that, you know, is beholden to corporate interests and the wealthy more than the people. And, you know, it's been a tough atmosphere for Democrats in a way, because, you know, with COVID, the argument that they had like sort of laid the groundwork for, it may not be, you know, top of mind with voters. And so what we're seeing is that they're kind of throwing, you know, what they have and seeing what sticks. I mean, the emphasis of late has been on judicial picks and abortion rights, in that the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has raised questions about whether the court will tilt in a way that could, you know, invalidate Roe v. Wade or undo the Affordable Care Act. And so they've also been running on Sununu's against Sununu as a sort of an anti-abortion candidate. And, you know, Sununu says he's pro-choice. He has said that he will fight any effort to repeal Roe v. Wade at the state level should it come to that. But, you know, Democrats point to his pick of Attorney General Gordon McDonald to lead New Hampshire's Supreme Court as sort of an analog to some of Trump's judicial nominations. McDonald was, of course, blocked by the Democratic Council. And so, you know, Democrats are trying to find inroads. I mean, Sununu's popular across the board due to his management from COVID, and a lot of, you know, it's looking tough. He has a cash advantage edge, but it's also true that presidential years tend to be strong for Democrats. Democrats have carried the top of the ticket in a presidential year. The Democrat win the presidency here in every year since 2000, and you have to go back to actually 1992 to find a year when a Republican won the corner office in New Hampshire in a presidential year. So there are structural things in Democrats' favor, but, you know, Sununu has a cash advantage, certainly name ID edge over Feltes, and, you know, polling indicates that people are satisfied with the job he's done managing COVID, which is something that's certainly top of mind.
And so it seems that, you know, Democratic efforts to tie Governor Sununu to President Trump simply aren't working.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll see when the votes are counted. I mean, you know, Sununu has been able to separate himself from Trump in a way that, you know, I think is frustrated Democrats, even though, as you know, as recently as yesterday, he condemned President Trump's failure to be more clear in distancing himself from white supremacy in the presidential debate. But Sununu also reiterated that he planned to vote for Trump. And, you know, in presidential years, it does tend to be very much, you know, kind of party line campaigning. I mean, Trump, Sununu is backing Trump. He's, you know, cut campaign ads for Matt Maurer's running the first CD. He's supporting Corky Messner over Gene Shaheen. That's not surprising behavior. You know, Sununu's most popular Republican in New Hampshire, and he wants to lift those candidates. And, you know, Democrats are pretty much running a campaign, you know, up and down the ticket as a referendum on Trump. And, you know, Sununu's being larded in there too. And there's certainly plenty of things Democrats are dissatisfied with Sununu on. But, you know, Sununu entered the general election with a more than 10-to-1 money advantage. And, you know, one thing to watch is the degree to which Democrats can marshal spending to potentially boost Feltes and by extension the rest of the ticket. The state Democratic Party spending $1 million on an ad on Feltes's behalf that is essentially linking Governor Sununu to President Trump, running that "I'm a Trump guy through and through" quote over and over again. We're going to hear a lot of that between now and Election Day, and like we'll see if it works.
Last night, a debate hosted by Black Lives Matter featured Dan Feltes and Libertarian candidate Daryl Perry. Governor Sununu opted out of this debate. His campaign said that they had received too many requests and were only participating in three forums, which are, quote, sponsored by respected media outlets with fair and impartial moderators. What effect is that likely to have on Governor Sununu?
Well, it's hard to know. Governor Sununu's, you know, he's supporting police reforms. He would say that, you know, he established a civil rights bureau in the Department of Justice at the state level, and that he's been supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement in New Hampshire. You know, he named a key member to his law enforcement task force. But, you know, candidates make decisions, and you know, I don't know exactly what went into Sununu's decision not to appear there, but it is interesting the degree to which verbal commitments to things like Black Lives Matter, particularly among Republican politicians, you know, how they're going to translate into actions down the line. I mean, it's a tactical decision on the governor's campaign to not attend that debate. The implications remain to be seen in terms of whether that means anything to big numbers of voters.
Mm-hmm. What about Daryl Perry? To what extent is the Libertarian Party a factor in this race?
Hard to know. I mean, Daryl Perry has certainly been vocal about complaining about his inability to get in debates, including, you know, I should add, the debate that we are hosting at NHPR, that he hasn't met the thresholds set by the news organizations running these debates. That's certainly a perennial argument. I mean, early on, you know, you saw in the Republican primary where Karen Testerman, conservative activist, ran against Governor Sununu, largely criticizing him for shutting down the state to the extent he did due to coronavirus. She gained no traction. You know, certainly some people will vote for Daryl Perry in a very close election. You know, that could make a difference, but it's hard to know at this point whether that could be a factor.
Does this appear to be a close election, Josh?
Well, the polling would indicate that that Governor Sununu holds a big edge. I mean, a lot of this is going to be tied to President Trump's performance. I mean, historically, the gubernatorial nominee, Republican gubernatorial nominees, don't run substantially different percentage-wise from the presidential nominee. That's one thing Democrats keep on reminding me when they say that, you know, Dan Feltes has a shot to make this a competitive race. You know, Sununu has done a decent job separating himself from Trump. COVID has probably been helpful from that. And, you know, there's also polling that indicates there's going to be a good deal of ticket splitting. UMass Lowell came out with a poll that indicated that, you know, there's people who are open to voting for, say, you know, Jean Shaheen and Chris Sununu. And, you know, one thing I'm looking for is whether or not the political circumstances surrounding coronavirus might make this a better year for incumbents in general, be they, you know, Jean Shaheen, Chris Sununu, Congressman Pappas, Congressman Custer, and potentially, you know, down ticket. And it's certainly the potential effect of the Biden-Trump race on the governor's race and down ticket will be interesting. I mean, after this year is going to be a redistricting year. One of the many bills that Governor Sununu vetoed was one setting up an independent redistricting commission. Redistricting happens after the census. This is a census year. It's going to be interesting to see what happens because the state senate was, those districts were written by a Republican. They're somewhat gerrymandered. They've made it possible for the Senate Republicans to keep their edge in the last election, which swung big for Democrats. And, you know, there's going to be an emphasis on both parties to, you know, win those down ballot races and see if they can have a stronger hand in the redistricting process. But that's obviously a bit ways off now.
Well, let's talk about one of the other incumbents you mentioned, Senator Jean Shaheen. She's being challenged by Republican Corky Messner. How serious a challenge does Messner pose right now?
Well, we'll see. I mean, the you know, Corky Messner's ties to New Hampshire are not longstanding. You know, he voted here absentee 2 years ago. He never has actually voted in the Senate race for the Senate seat here that Jean Shaheen now holds. You know, he's from Colorado and had a second residence here, and he's basically running, you know, as a kind of Trump ally, saying that he wants to go and help Trump achieve his agenda. And, you know, his argument against Jean Shaheen is essentially she's a career politician. She's gone Washington. You know, that's an argument that people make against longstanding members of Congress and Senate, and they, you know, they don't work until they do. And, you know, we'll see. It does not appear that Messner is in a terribly strong position. I mean, Jean Shaheen's a well-known candidate, formidable candidate. She released a long list of Republicans who support her, and some of those people, I will say, are Republicans who are always on the list of Republicans that Democrats trot out in campaign season saying, see, I have bipartisan support, but you know, Jean Shaheen has strong ties. She, you know, people in the business community know that she's, you know, increasing her seniority in Washington. She certainly has many supporters. It's certainly going to be an uphill climb for Messner.
And I want to touch really briefly, Josh, on the presidential race. We've seen Vice President Pence here. Dr. Joe Biden was expected to visit the state as well. Are we seeing New Hampshire play that swing state role again in the presidential election?
Well, we've certainly seen, I mean, beyond Vice President Pence, we've seen Donald Trump Jr. spending time here, Eric Trump, Melania Trump actually quickly dipped in to Concord Hospital a few weeks ago. The president himself was here, of course, at Manchester Airport not so long ago. And the Trump campaign sees New Hampshire. I mean, he lost it by less than a percentage point to Hillary Clinton in 2016. New Hampshire is the state where he won the first primary, he claimed, in 2016. And it's a state where potentially the demographics, old, white, you know, could play in his favor. And, you know, New Hampshire's four electoral votes are four electoral votes. And you know, it's a state where they believe they can be competitive. You know, we'll see, as I mentioned, you know, Democrats tend to run strong in presidential years. I mean, whether or not, you know, obviously Joe Biden himself did not do terribly well in the New Hampshire primary. You may recall he left before the votes were tallied and, mm-hmm. you know, then won in South Carolina and really swept to the nomination. But, you know, this race is really a referendum on Trump. And, you know, polling indicates that, you know, Trump's, you know, down about 7 points here. We'll see. The Trump people have certainly invested time and money in the state, which is an indication that they think it's a state where they could have a shot.
And HPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers, thank you very much for being on the program today.
You're welcome, Peter.
And just a reminder for our listeners, NHPR is hosting a series of debates with candidates in the major races this month. Our first debate is on Wednesday. We'll have the candidates for the 1st Congressional District, Democrat Chris Pappas and Republican Matt Maurer. That's Wednesday morning, live at 9 here on NHPR. And just to recap what we've been hearing about absentee voting, you are able to register to vote before the election or in person at the polls on Election Day, November 3rd. Because of COVID-19, any voter can now choose to register by mail. Officials recommend mailing voter registration paperwork as soon as possible. And for more information on voting in the election, you can check out NHPR's voting guide at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. And we're joined now by Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio, to talk about a major race there that's getting national attention between Republican incumbent Senator Susan Collins and Democrat Sarah Gideon. Steve Missler, thank you very much for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
So Susan Collins is well known, having represented Maine in the Senate since 1997. What can you tell us about her challenger, Sarah Gideon?
Well, Sarah Gideon, she was received a big bump early on, and she declared, you know, her candidacy over a year ago, back in June of 2019, and it was immediately endorsed by Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, and with that came a bunch of endorsements from groups like Emily's List and Planned Parenthood, et cetera. And, you know, she's really rode that momentum to now where she is running neck and neck with Senator Collins, which is really extraordinary given that Senator Collins has won her reelections handily since 1996 and has been one of the most popular public figures in political figures in Maine until basically the Trump era. I mean, what we've seen since the president was inaugurated in 2017 is a steep decline in Collins' popularity, which is attributed in, you know, to some key votes that she's taken to support his agenda, most notably the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and of course the Republican tax overhaul of 2017, which she was a key vote there. And so those are two major issues in the campaign. And you know, Collins has her coalition has always been Republicans, the independents in Maine, which until this year have vastly outnumbered the registered party voters. And even Democrats have supported Senator Collins over the years. But that three-legged stool has been dismantled in the last year. And so she's, you know, she's really struggling at this point and leaning on her Republican support more than she has had to in the past.
And they had the candidates in this race, and they're more than just two, but they held their second debate earlier this week. What key issues came up at that debate?
Well, you wouldn't be surprised to hear that the Supreme Court was one of them. I mean, Senator Collins, because of the Kavanaugh vote, has really been under the microscope since the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She came out pretty early and said that she didn't think it was appropriate to vote on Ginsburg's replacement before the election. She's come out to say that she'll actually oppose the president's nominee if the vote occurs before the election.
Not before Inauguration Day 2021, but before the election, which is a distinction worth making.
Correct. That's exactly right. So we don't know what she would do in the lame duck, for example. So if, the nominee or the vote were to take place after the election, we really don't know how she would vote. She hasn't said, but she has said, that she will not support the nominee if that vote takes place before the election, which of course has resulted in a lot of pressure here on the right. And President Trump himself even criticized her initially, although he's sort of tamped that down recently. He was not happy with her announcement early on, but that's where we stand right now. But that was one of the key issues. And of course, healthcare too, which is of course linked to the Supreme Court, because there's a big case looming right after the election that could completely dismantle the Affordable Care Act, or at least hobble it. And so that's on the ballot too. And that's right in the Democrats' wheelhouse. And so Sarah Gideon, who's the Democratic challenger, has been hammering that issue ever since the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Well, Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Yep, my pleasure.
And we're going to link as well to Steve's reporting at nhpr.org. This week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we're going to start our latest in the miniseries we're calling Down Ballot, in which we take a look at some of the elected officials you'll be choosing in this election season, candidates that may not get a whole lot of attention. We'd like to give them some attention today. Stay tuned. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for tuning in, and a shout out to listeners who were paying attention to our segment earlier on the show about absentee voting. Of course, a lot of questions about that. Worth noting this comment from Susan. Susan wrote in to let us know. She says, "Please warn people not to fill out their absentee ballot with a Sharpie pen. I did this and the ink leaked through to the other side of the page, making an additional mark in the box for president that I didn't intend. Now I need to call my town hall to find out if my ballot will count, if I can white out the unintended mark, or if I can return this ballot to be shredded and get a new one. I want to make sure that my vote counts." That's a comment from Susan, and we do tend to get a lot of comments about absentee ballots here at New Hampshire Public Radio, and questions about how it goes. And we want to answer all of your questions as best as we can. And if you have questions, check out NHPR's voting guide at nhpr.org. By November 3rd, voters will choose candidates for office, for president, for governor, for Senate. But you're also going to be casting votes for local offices. So every Friday morning, we've got this mini-series we're calling Down Ballot, a refresher on what you should know about local elected officials you'll be choosing on election today. And today we're going to talk about county attorney. And Paul Kuno Booth is here to help us out. He's a reporter for the Keene Sentinel. Hey, Paul.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us about county attorney. What kind of power does the county attorney hold?
Yeah, so the county attorney is the chief prosecutor in the county. It's what some other states call a district attorney or DA. And they are responsible for prosecuting most felonies and sometimes misdemeanors in their counties. And they really do have a lot of power in the criminal justice system. You know, we've talked a lot about police this year, and police, of course, are another key actor. But prosecutors, once police make an arrest, prosecutors are the people who look at that arrest and say, okay, is there actually the evidence here to go forward? If there's not, they can just decline to prosecute that right away. If they do move forward, they're the person who decides, what charges are we actually going to file? And then they play a very important role in determining the outcome. And one reason for this is that most criminal cases nowadays never go to trial. They're worked out through a plea bargaining process. And so it really matters, you know, if you have a defense attorney and a county attorney or other prosecutor negotiating, you know, it really matters. Is that prosecutor saying, you know, I'm going to insist on a felony conviction in this case, or I'll let your client plead down to a misdemeanor. I'm going to insist on, you know, jail time because I think this kind of offense is serious enough, or, you know, I'm going to accept probation or some kind of, you know, treatment focused sentence. You know, there's enough discretion built into the system that county attorneys in different parts of the state, in theory, can sort of take different approaches to how they prosecute the same types of crimes.
Mm-hmm. And how does the county attorney impact our daily life?
So for most people, it's probably a minimal direct impact. But, you know, if you are accused of a crime or you're a victim of a crime, it really does matter who's in that seat. I think the broader implication for more people is just, you know, this is a really key position, a really key voice in sort of the broader public safety system. And so, you know, there's a lot of attention nowadays on alternatives in the criminal justice system, whether that's sort of pretrial diversion or, you know, drug courts, which are well established in New Hampshire. And for programs like that to work, often you really need the prosecutor's buy-in. So having someone who's, you know, interested in finding these different solutions to, for example, the opioid crisis or whatever, if you're someone who cares about how is my community tackling these issues, right? Or, you know, if you're interested in finding alternatives to incarceration for, you know, problems stemming from substance use or mental health, again, the prosecutor, they're not the only person, but they can be a really key player in those discussions.
And who usually runs for and gets elected to this position?
Well, you have to be a lawyer, which definitely shrinks the pool of candidates. And this is actually a position that often goes uncontested. 7 of the 10 races this year, I believe, just have one person, the incumbent, running. And that's a common pattern in New Hampshire. So often it's the incumbent who's been there a while who sort of gets reelected without opposition. Mm-hmm. There are a couple more contested races in the bigger counties. And nationwide, there's actually been an interesting movement in the past couple of years to sort of elect quote unquote progressive prosecutors who, you know, use that discretion they have to try and minimize incarceration or you know, make reforms to the system. But the short answer is not that many people run for it.
Not that many people. Lots of uncontested races, as you detail in your article. We've got a link to it at nhpr.org. Paul Kunubuth, why is this even an elected position?
That's a great question. I don't know the full history of it, but I think the idea is that it does allow some democratic accountability in this position. So, you know, like I was saying, this progressive prosecutor movement, that's something that, you know, activists around the country said, hey, you know, this is an elected position. We can support a candidate who believes in a different type of criminal justice and, you know, use our voices to achieve that. By the other token, of course, there are also people who run on sort of more tough on crime positions, but in theory, at least, there's the potential for voters to choose kind of what vision they want or who they want in that office.
Mm-hmm. And is this a 2-year term?
It is.
A 2-year term. Yeah. And what about this year? Any news about this position anywhere in the state?
Yeah. So like I said, there are 3 contested races, I believe, in the bigger counties, Rockingham, Hillsborough, and Merrimack. And, you know, in Hillsborough County, the incumbent Democrat, Michael Conlon, was elected last time around. He came in without criminal or prosecution experience. And, you know, there's been sort of a high profile issue with, you know, the New Hampshire Attorney General's office kind of stepping in and running that office for a period of time because of, you know, some issues that they cataloged, including, you know, communication with police departments and sort of review of plea deals that now has control has been handed back over. And, you know, Conlon has said this is these issues predated my term. I've, you know, been working on them. There are underfunding issues, he says. But I do expect that to sort of come up in that race. The his opponent, his Republican challenger, actually held the office before in the early 2000s and has also served as a judge. In Rockingham County, you know, there's a Republican incumbent, and the Democratic challenger says, you know, he's running to kind of, he wants to take things in sort of a less punitive direction, he says. Merrimack County, I don't know as much about the dynamics of that race, but it's another, you know, fairly new Democratic incumbent who's being challenged by a Republican.
And to whom does the county attorney report? Is that the state attorney general? Or is report a funny word? I mean, because are they accountable to the voters, but also do they have to yield some judgment to the state attorney general?
Yeah, I believe the state attorney general is sort of responsible for overseeing them. And that's where you can have these situations where, you know, they maybe step in if they think something needs to be different. But usually it's sort of, you know, they're kind of independent actors. And then also, you know, to some extent, they're, you know, with the county and budgets and stuff, they're part of that system as well.
Part of that system. So where can people go to find out more about these races?
So the ACLU actually recently sent out some questionnaires to the different candidates for this position, asking about, you know, their views on racial justice and drug prosecutions and some other topics. So that's a good place to look. There's been news coverage about some of these candidates. And one other thing I just mentioned is that, you know, criminal justice is one of these issues where partisan affiliation doesn't always track directly with policy. It's not as clean as some other issues. So I would just encourage voters to actually read up on your candidate. You know, there are Republicans who are kind of more on a law and order track, but also some who are more in a libertarian direction. And you know, among Democrats, there are maybe more kind of traditional law enforcement types and also these quote unquote progressives. So, you know, just looking at the D or the R by their name doesn't necessarily tell you what their views are.
So worth digging a little deeper on each of these, not simply voting just down party lines.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And here are some of the stories the NHPR newsroom has been following this week. New Hampshire health officials say there have been 47 cases of COVID-19 among residents and staff at long-term care facility in Bedford. Health Commissioner Lori Chibinette said yesterday that 33 of the cases reported involved residents at the Bedford Hills Center. 14 were staff members. She said the number of cases at the Bedford facility going from none to 47 in such a short time shows how fast this disease can spread. Also, students at the University of New Hampshire are protesting a male professor accused of posting offensive messages while pretending to be an immigrant woman on Twitter. A professor in UNH's chemistry department is accused of operating a Twitter account that for nearly 2 years spread misogynist, anti-transgender, and anti-Black Lives Matter content. The account repeatedly tweeted that it was run by a woman of color. The Twitter account and a personal account allegedly run by the professor were both deleted earlier this week. And New Hampshire has fined a metal recycler nearly $3 million for improperly disposing of hazardous waste on its site. The $2.7 million fine is the largest the state has issued for a hazardous waste violation and will be put into the state's hazardous waste fund. The settlement with New England Metal Recycling, Inc. in Madbury follows actions that it failed to properly dispose of materials described as auto shredder residue. Instead, it buried about 20,000 cubic yards of the material on its site. Paul Kuno Booth, I want to talk to you about one more story before we wrap up here, and that's Christopher Cantwell, keen white nationalist, was found guilty of threatening and extortion. What's the details of this story?
Yeah, that's right. This is a pretty wild case. As you mentioned, Christopher Cantwell is this white nationalist podcaster and online personality who has lived in Keene. A little over a year ago, he, according to the government, sent some threats to another online white nationalist podcaster and personality. He was kind of feuding with that guy's group. And, you know, this is a group that was using pseudonyms and posting just really, you know, vile stuff on the internet about, you know, in praise of mass shooters and all. You know, they have this feud. Cantwell essentially threatens to dox or you know, post identifying information about this guy, post pictures of his family, if he doesn't give up the identity of a third online white nationalist figure. So this message exchange on the social media app Telegram gets posted publicly online. The FBI, according to court testimony, was monitoring this channel, saw those messages, started investigating this, what they said was a threat and attempt to extort, and arrested him in January. And so he stood trial last week, and the jury returned a guilty verdict on two counts this week.
So has he been sentenced yet, or do we know when he will be sentenced?
He'll be sentenced in early January.
Well, Paul Kuno Booth of the Keene Sentinel, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on this and other stories. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We appreciate you for tuning in today. All the stories we discussed today are available at our website, nhpr.org, which is where, it bears repeating, you can find that voter guide. NHPR.org is the place to find that. NHPR's program manager, Michael Brindley, produced the show. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.